Hello, I'm Dr. Sarah Jarvis, and welcome to the HepCast, a podcast series about people fighting to eliminate viral hepatitis, a virus that affects 350 million people worldwide. In our first episode of Series 2, we'll explore mother-to-child transmission of viral hepatitis, look at the impact that hepatitis is having on mothers and children worldwide, and, really importantly, the need to address the stigma that mothers face. And joining us today, we have three powerful, passionate women who've dedicated their lives to health research, to raise awareness of hepatitis B, and to advocate for health quality. And it is a pleasure to have you with me, ladies. So I'm just going to introduce you. Nafisa Yusuf is a community advocate. She was diagnosed with HBV when she was a high school student. Unfortunately, due to lack of awareness and support, which she is working to counter, I might add, Nafisa became a community advocate to speak to communities, to health professionals, and importantly, of course, to policymakers to raise awareness for people living with HBV. Missy Bright is a consultant, clinical pharmacist, a lecturer, and we had this debate. Is she a public health manager or is she a practitioner? And the answer is she is both, ladies and gentlemen, because she doesn't just manage, she does it too. And she's based in Lagos in Nigeria. She is a vice chair and CEO of Live Well Initiative, LWI, which is a self-sustaining non-profit healthcare social enterprise, which is targeted at empowering populations across the spectrum with that all-important health literacy. Last, but by no means least, Cynthia Reisa Tamanju has worked on the ground in South Africa and Namibia with women living with HBV, but we will hear that she is there no more. And we'll hear about her exciting new role in just a minute. But she is a qualified medical virologist, and she obtained her PhD from the University of Stellenbosch in Cape Town, South Africa. Her PhD focused on the feasibility of, and now you will see why we have invited her today, implementing routine antenatal point-of-care HBV testing and the cost-effectiveness of a screen, treat, vaccinate intervention against HBV mother-to-child transmission. Ladies, welcome. What a pleasure it is for me to have you here. I'm going to start, if I may, with Cynthia. So, Cynthia, I did mention that you have an exciting new job, but let's just look about what your role spans, because quite frankly, I'm exhausted just hearing what you do. You're not just the medical virologist. You work in health economics and you work in public health. So tell us a little bit about your role.
Good morning, Sarah. Thank you so much for having me this morning. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you my knowledge and expertise, if I may call so, on mother-to-child transmission of hepatitis. As you mentioned, indeed, I have delved into medical virology because I was initially trained as a medical virology with a PhD. Then I went on with health economics, which was mostly bringing my postdoctorate, before going again doing public health, having obtained a master recently, and starting a new job as a scientific project officer at the National Institute of Public Health in France. So my role has been, in the past years, I won't say a roller coaster, but interesting.
I think a roller coaster will do very nicely.
So as a medical virologist, I predominantly worked on hepatitis B, specifically mother-to-child transmission. It was really on the ground looking at what's happening, what's the prevalence, who are those mothers who are infected with hepatitis B, and what is it that we can do in terms of helping them to prevent transmission to their newborns. And when it came to the health economics part, it was mostly about understanding what are the costs of these different interventions that we have and that we know of to prevent mother-to-child transmission? And with that cost, what are those interventions which work best with the little resources that we have available, especially in low-resource settings?
Brilliant.
Now, I pushed the button with public health because I hope when I grow up to become like BC, a public health practitioner still within the sector of hepatitis B.
Fantastic. That makes Perfect center. I love the idea of I hope when I grow up. I think most people, when they hear your CV, would think you're pretty grown up already. And Nafisa, can I come to you? Because you, I hope, were listening to that, just giving a silent little cheer there at all the work that Cynthia's doing, because it very much complements the work I think that you have been doing as a community advocate. But I'm going, if I may, just to go back a little bit, if you can cast your mind back to when you were at high school. Can you tell us a little bit about when you were diagnosed and what had encouraged you to get tested?
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, everyone. It's such a great and privilege to be part of this conversation as someone who is incredibly passionate about preventing mother-child transmission. So I was diagnosed back in high school, and the reason I got diagnosed was because I felt ill. I was experiencing all the usual symptoms of headaches and dizziness and nauseous and just feeling really exhausted. And I saw my local doctor, got tested, and that's when I found out I had hepatitis B.
So can I just stop you there and say, you make it sound really simple. I saw my local doctor and I got tested. Hepatitis B would not be, for a young, apparently entirely healthy woman at high school, would not be top of my list as a GP. And I know that a lot of people do say they go through a lot of other testing first, and it takes a while to get there. Do you remember anything about that? Did you have liver tests which showed inflammation in your liver, or how did they get there? What was the journey?
That's a really good point. It's actually a funny story. So when I went to my GP, you know, he said to me, it's probably nothing. And then I came back to my next appointment and it's like, you've got a chronic disease. And that was just a simple blood test. So sorry, going back, when I was diagnosed, I was referred to a specialist was managed by a specialist and not the general local doctor. I was actually referred to him through the dermatologist clinic and not my GP. So my file ended up at, which I just learned. And I was like, what? What the hell happened there?
Okay, you were diagnosed with hepatitis and ended up in the skin specialist.
No. So what had happened was, when I was younger, I had a lot of acne, as you know, teenager. So I would have seen the dermatology clinic. So it sounds like they found out that I had hepatitis B, but didn't tell me, and instead just referred me to a specialist. The reason why I mentioned this is that's probably common, I reckon, around the world, where people either get diagnosed or it's not communicated well to them. And so for me, I've always thought I was diagnosed through my GP, my local doctor, but it sounds like it was through a different service. So anyway, that's how I found out.
That's really quite scary that you were diagnosed, but nobody told you, they just referred you on. Bissy, I'm going to come to you and ask if you've heard stories like that before, because I have to say, I am really quite shocked at that. As a GP, I'm really quite shocked at that. But I'm guessing, Bissy, that this is not uncommon.
Yes, we've heard many stories like that. In the first place, it's a bit difficult getting GPs to make a proper and correct diagnosis of viral hepatitis, because they usually wait to see distorted liver function tests. But that usually doesn't happen at the beginning of the disease. And so many times there is a missed diagnosis. But even when there is a diagnosis, the patient does not really get all the counseling they need. And that is a major challenge we also have here. I think part of the reason is because patients do get stigmatized in this part of the world. In Africa, there's a lot of stigma attached to viral hepatitis. And so when a patient gets a diagnosis, the patient is left to go home to the family to go sort it out. I'm not trying to indict the health system. I'm part of the health system. But I'm just saying that we really need to disseminate more information and destigmatize viral hepatitis, especially in Africa. So it's not uncommon at all.
So believe me, it's not just in Africa that needs the stigmatizing. Cynthia, I could see you nodding there. And I think there is very much a resonance there. But I'm going to come to you as a medical virologist, because Bissy's raised a really important point. She says that, you know, often the diagnosis doesn't get made until after liver function tests are abnormal, which can be fairly late in the disease. But the issue we've got is that, of course, in the early stages of the disease, the symptoms are very non-specific. And certainly at medical school, I would have been taught, if somebody's got
tiredness or they're feeling a bit off, you've got to check the thyroid, you've got to check their full blood count to make sure they're not anemic, and you would routinely check their liver and their kidneys to make sure that they're both working okay. So how can we raise awareness of earlier stages and start thinking hepatitis at an earlier stage, Cynthia?
It really depends on the population that we're working with. If, for example, I'm talking, if we come back to the issue of population of pregnant women, I think everything starts with screening. And the issue we have in Africa is that it's not systematically done, like, for example, we're doing with HIV. So if we can start there, then we can think about, okay, what next? And now the next thing is education. BC mentioned, I think it's really important. Because what happened is that often in some clinics in Africa, it's the nurse that will see the patient. And those nurses don't necessarily have all the informations that are related with how to take care of a specific patient. And you'd be surprised that even some general practitioners do not have the tools or all the knowledge required to either refer the pregnant woman for further care, or sometimes that cascade of care is not even present in the system. And so education, I think here, it's a really important factor to consider both at the healthcare practitioner level, but also for the patient, because from the patient's side, he's empowered to demand or to ask for the care that he or she needs to take care of himself.
That is a fantastic answer. Thank you. And Nafisa, I'm going to come to you because obviously you were hearing Cynthia there talking about education. And that's what you do. So can you tell us a little bit more about your role as a viral hepatitis advocate, and indeed what inspired you to take up that role?
So I guess I wear two dual hats in that professionally a social researcher at the WHO Collaborative Centre for Hepatitis here in Australia. And part of my work is advocating for change, advocating for community lived experience, particularly the voices of people who are affected by hepatitis B. And also personally, obviously this is a personal course for me, and I've been working in this sector for almost 10 years. And all the issues that both BC and Cynthia have talked about, we've seen. So I think there's a global experience of similarities, no matter if you're in Africa or here in Australia. And the reason why I became an advocate is to let others know that they're not alone, to raise awareness and normalize hepatitis B discussions. And also to let people know there's nothing to be ashamed of. People shouldn't be stigmatized and discriminated against just because they have hepatitis B. But also secondly, to advocate to governments, to policymakers, to adequately to respond to hepatitis B. And I guess in terms of people who've inspired me is my doctor, who has a huge impact. And I'm grateful to have such a great role model in public health who have encouraged me and to have supported me through this journey. But I also have a family who are, you know, impacted by hepatitis B. I am culturally from Somalia. I came to Australia when I was about 12 as a young refugee kid, and going through the healthcare system and learning to navigate the healthcare system when you don't speak English is incredibly hard and challenging. And part of that is what drives me, because I know what it's like to go through this and to be diagnosed with a chronic disease when you don't really understand. To even explain hepatitis B to anybody was really hard, because in my language, there's only one name for hepatitis. There's no differentiating between hepatitis A, B, or C. So often people think it's hepatitis A, you know, you get sick, but eventually you recover and you're fine. And so that impacts the whole message of ongoing care and treatment if you're on treatment. I think we've made some progress, but we definitely still have a long way to go in terms of supporting mothers, but also preventing mother-to-child transmission.
I don't think there's any doubt that we all have much to do, but I think in some areas more than in others. Nafisa, everything you're saying absolutely resonates with me, and I have absolutely no doubt that it resonates with Bissy as well, because we mentioned in our introduction of you, Bissy, the Live Well Initiative, but of course you're also involved in the Women in Hepatitis Africa Initiative. So tell us a little about that.
I want to first of all support what Nafisa said. She actually highlighted the challenges that the population have, especially people who find themselves at the base of the pyramid, either due to being displaced as a population or due to language barriers, etc., etc. Those are some of the major challenges, and explaining hepatitis away becomes more difficult in dealing with such disparities of populations. And so such populations should be given the necessary attention. And Cynthia actually also mentioned the fact that there are gaps in the cascade of care. We have many gaps here, and those gaps need to be filled. And the biggest gap is in the education gap, because like Cynthia explained very carefully, the education gap is not just with the patients, but even among practitioners themselves, where you have trained nurses, trained physicians, trained laboratory personnel, and other trained medical health workers who have very little knowledge of viral hepatitis. So training and education is very paramount in answering the hepatitis question and in eliminating hepatitis. So having said that, at the Live Well Initiative, LWI, we actually have a goal to eliminate viral hepatitis by 2030. We set off with this goal as soon as it was announced globally and started marking every World Hepatitis Day from the very first term in July 2011. We didn't really know that that would be done, but the Junior Chambers International, the JCI, invited us to come and talk about viral hepatitis, and that's how we picked up the hepatitis burden. And then we found the burden tilted more towards the women. And so in April 2016, we launched the Women in Hepatitis Africa. But I must give the credit to Professor Barry Blauvelt, a mentor of mine, who convened a hepatitis meeting in New York in September 2015 for 25 women around the world who are working on hepatitis. And I was one of them. And I had the privilege to meet the Health and Human Services head of hepatitis, the head of CDC hepatitis desk, the head of WHO hepatitis desk. And that really inspired me that if women all over the world are working on hepatitis, then we in Africa can do that too. There were two African women at that meeting. Yes, that's what really inspired us. Women in Hepatitis Africa, which is the only African women's organization working on viral hepatitis.
Great to hear that you have been so instrumental in the only women's organization focusing strictly on viral hepatitis in Africa. That's really inspiring. But as you so rightly say, women, I think, do face perhaps disproportionate stigma. And I'm going, if I may, to come back to you, Cynthia, and ask you how, at a very early stage in your career, you decided to focus on hepatitis B mother-to-child transmission. You clearly saw that there was an unmet need there. Tell us about that.
Actually, everything started from my master's degree, which was when basically I was introduced into the world of hepatitis B. And back then, my project with my supervisor, Professor Monique Anderson, was about looking at how much of infants born from HIV-infected pregnant women in South Africa were also co-infected with hepatitis B. Now, it mostly was around laboratory testing for hepatitis B at the lab and determining, finding in the blood of these kids there was hep B or not. And then once I had to write a thesis associated to that master, and the more I was reading, the more I noticed that there was very little known about hep B mother-to-child transmission in South Africa, but in Africa as a whole. For some reason, it resonated with me. And for me, it became actually quite necessary to delve more into that topic, especially that we know that back then and even today, most of the data that we had was from Asia, and there was little about Africa. So we didn't understand how big was that phenomenon in Africa, because there was always that idea that hepatitis B is transmitted when you're a child, but from horizontal transmission, from sharing sharp objects with families who are infected with hepatitis B.
So let's just clarify for people who are listening. So vertical transmission is transmission from a mother to a child, either during pregnancy, etc. Whereas horizontal transmission is transmission from person to person, as in, as you say, sharing needles or infected blood and so on.
Exactly. So back then, that was the idea about how hepatitis B is transmitted in the African population. So we knew very little about this phenomenon of mother-to-child transmission of hepatitis B in Africa. And from there, I told Monique that, you know what, I want to continue with that, but I just don't want to be at the lab. I also want to go underground, meet those women, try and understand what are the needs and what is it that we can do in terms of feasibility of implementing strategies to fight that phenomenon and to protect those babies.
Brilliant. And of course, Nafisa, you have been very involved in this as well. So tell us about your research for prevention of mother-to-child transmission.
Just a bit of background. Here in Australia, there are about 200,000 people living with chronic hepatitis B and about 61,000 here in the state of Victoria that I'm in. And we're investigating barriers to eliminating mother-to-child transmission through a perinatal hepatitis B research. And this is comprehensively investigating the current status of mother-to-child transmission using both qualitative and quantitative approaches. So this includes interviewing mothers with hepatitis B about their lived experience, analyzing data linkage to understand the uptake of interventions and the cascade of care for mothers. And also, lastly, investigating services level or system level factors for pregnant women. So looking at healthcare services and what are the barriers to optimal care for women and their infants. And we're very excited because we're just wrapping up that research as of this month. And what we found is that women often are diagnosed at a very complex time. So during either migration or perinatal screening, which is not the right time to be diagnosed with a chronic disease. And then you add the whole layers of language and health literacy and just the overwhelming news. And what we found is that there are obviously still gaps in terms of the quality of information and support that is provided to mothers. There's obviously clinical care gaps for mothers and also the recording and reporting of vaccination, but also documentation of hepatitis B, because what we found is that obviously if something is documented, it's hard to evaluate, it's hard to monitor, it's hard to follow up. And we've seen that in a huge gap in our research. And I think that really complements with a lot of Cynthia and Busy have been talked about. And yeah, I think it's just that we need a very much like standardized programs and policies to coordinate the approach rather than sort of a single point of care, for example, but it has to be incorporated into the system, particularly through pregnancy.
So in order to do that, of course, you have to have testing. In order to have testing, you have to have awareness. Busy. Do you think that knowledge of mother-to-child transmission is low among the populations you work with? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yes, it is very, very low. Number one, because of the stigma, people don't really talk that much about it. And then secondly, HIV as a disease had a larger than life image among the people. And so people didn't really talk about anything else in the viral hemisphere except HIV. And so the knowledge is very little among the women. And you find out that even when women get a diagnosis of viral hepatitis, they really don't understand what it's all about. I'll talk about Nigeria and then go to the larger continent of Africa. Right now in Nigeria, the federal government has now adopted a policy of prevention of mother-to-child transmission in viral hepatitis. And to make this simple and understandable by everybody, what they have done is that viral hepatitis screening is now a routine antenatal test in Nigeria. That is the government policy. Of course, implementation-wise, we would say it is not yet implemented all over the country. But yes, the women are now getting to know. Within the Live Well Initiative and Women in Hepatitis Africa, we have this training program that we are running all over Africa to train women as hepatitis champions. And the goal is to train one woman who then trains another 20 women in her immediate sphere. And so we hope that more and more African women will be able to understand what viral hepatitis is. To do this, we've trained about 5,000 women in the past 3 to 4 years, and we hope to do more. And the WHO has also prioritized PMTCT, which is the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of viral hepatitis. So I believe that from the grassroots level and with the big organizations like WHO, I believe that with time, many more women will get to know about viral hepatitis. But in our own communities where we work, I can confidently tell you that most of the women now know what viral hepatitis is. We have trained 70 very, very low literacy, never been schooled women as viral hepatitis champions. And some of them, not all of them, have also trained at least 20 other women. So when we talk of viral hepatitis, they now understand it. And we've had even a focus group discussion with low literacy women talking about viral hepatitis.
I'm fascinated at that idea that HIV, there is a downside to that, that effectively, because you'd have thought this is a virus and hepatitis is a virus, and surely by increasing knowledge of one, we will almost bring the other one with us. But what you're actually saying is there is a risk that if you put all the focus on HIV, people assume that is the only virus in town, as it were. So, Cynthia, let's come to you, because Bissy mentioned there antenatal testing or getting tested. Tell us a bit more about antenatal point of care hepatitis testing, because, of course, this is where it all started for you, as it were, with your PhD. Although I do hear what you said about, no, it actually started with my master's and then I did my PhD. But it was pretty close to the beginning. Tell us about that. Do you think that would make a difference to elimination goals?
So when people usually go for any diagnostic, it will be blood taken out and sent to a very centralized laboratory facilities and get their results a couple of days later, being called the clinics to get their results. Well, what antenatal point of care test, those are basically will be devices that I use at the point of care. And by the point of care, I mean at the place of health service delivery at the antenatal clinic. So that's the place where the woman will be tested for her hepatitis B. And by the time she leaves the clinic from her antenatal visit, she will have known whether or not she is hepatitis B and if potentially if she has a higher risk of transmitting the virus or the infection to her baby. So now, with that being said in mind and the goals of eliminating viral hepatitis by 2030, if you look closely, it was about upscaling testing and treatment, and obviously upscaling hepatitis B vaccination to prevent mother-to-child transmission. Now, if we want to identify these individuals who are hepatitis B infected, then it starts with testing. So by testing these pregnant women early in their pregnancy, we are able to identify more of these individuals who are infected with hepatitis B. And with identifying them early, we can take measures or precautions to make sure this mother does not pass it on to her baby, and therefore that woman decreasing incidence of new infections. Now, in terms of the mother herself, if she knows or when she knows her hepatitis B status and we do all the different laboratory tests associated with hepatitis B, we can determine whether or not at that point in time she needs treatment, not only to prevent transmission of the hepatitis B to her baby, but also for her own care. Because as we know, viral hepatitis B may lead at a later stage at liver complications such as liver cancer. If we test diagnosed early, we are able to take the necessary precaution, do the necessary tests, and therefore make sure that we do not have more incident cases, but also treat the disease where it is necessary to avoid mortality and morbidity later in the life of this pregnant woman, and therefore meeting elimination goals.
From what I'm hearing, I hear so many people who are so passionate about this, working so hard. I genuinely feel that it's doable, but there is so much to do. Now, let's just drill down a little bit more on that idea of treating but preventing transmission. So in your PhD, you discussed screen, treat, vaccinate, intervention to reduce the risk of hepatitis B mother-to-child transmission. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and just remind us how it would be implemented? Because point-of-care testing sounds amazing, but a woman leaves the clinic knowing, but she then needs to have next steps. Everything else needs to happen too.
The screen, treat, vaccinate intervention actually is a combination of three different control measures against hepatitis B. And I already mentioned what screening is about, detecting, identifying these pregnant women who are infected with hepatitis B at an early stage. Then the next step will be treating. So now the treatment, unlike what we see with HIV, isn't a systematic thing. If she's HIV positive, we immediately put her on treatment like we do with HIV. But rather, there are a set of diagnostic tests to be performed, such as determining the levels of viral particles or genetic materials of the virus in the mother's blood, And if really high, that's when she will get into the treatment, the adequate treatment to reduce those levels of the viral genetic materials and therefore reducing the transmission of the infection to her baby. Now, from there comes the last part, which is vaccination. And as we all know, that's the cornerstone of any programs or intervention that is to put in place against mother-to-child transmission. And we do not need to vaccinate a baby depending on the mother's hepatitis B status. WHO recommendations are it's done automatically, systematically, without having to know that. But when we find ourselves in the case of an hepatitis B exposed baby, it gives that baby a boost to make sure that that baby is protected. And it can be what, again, like I mentioned, the hepatitis B vaccination, but also what we know as the hepatitis B immunoglobulin. Now, in terms of implementation, honestly, screening routinely using point of care testing shouldn't be an issue. Why I say so is because many countries around the globe are already performing that for HIV. And I strongly believe of using those infrastructures that are already in place for HIV to do the same thing for hepatitis B. We do not need to reinvent the wheels. We have the infrastructures. We know how to use point of care tests for HIV. So the principle remains the same. When you test a pregnant woman who arrives at the first antenatal clinic visit for HIV, you have this little device next to the HIV one, and you also test for hepatitis B. And by the end of the day, she knows her HIV and hepatitis B status. Now, the tricky part will be about knowing whether or not she has a high risk of transmitting. And it is true that today we have issues in terms of accessing point of care testing to determine the infectiousness of this pregnant woman. But there's more work being done on that. And so with political will, with the research and community, I'm sure we can get to a point whereby small little devices could be developed and made accessible to low and high reach settings, to make sure that these women get to know whether or not they prevent transmission to their babies.
That sounds so sensible when you say it like that. It's just like, well, they're already doing it for HIV, so why not just set up the boxes next to it? And you're right. It does make perfect sense. I suspect in real life, it may be a little more complicated than that, because as you say, there are financial implications, there are resource implications, and indeed, as Bissy has pointed out, there are educational implications. But I think it's a starting point, isn't it? And as you so rightly say, we have managed it for HIV, and yet now we have something where, in fact, we have already got the facilities in place. So the principle has been established. Now, Nafisa, you, of course, were diagnosed before you became a mum, but you are a mum. Can you tell us a little bit how you felt when you were pregnant with your children in terms of any risk of transmission?
I just quickly wanted to add in what Cynthia was saying around testing. I think absolutely pregnancy is a crucial time to engage women and their families. I'm also a strong believer in universal testing. And actually, I feel like there's so many missed opportunities to not test people. People are often seeing their local doctor for all other health conditions or just general checkups. And what we're advocating for here at the Peter Doherty and my colleagues is that universal testing, which just tests all adults, obviously with consent, just like the United States are currently testing adults for hepatitis C, regardless of where they're from or risk factors. And I think that just makes it so much easier for both the healthcare system, but also for communities, and not stigmatizing. For myself, I absolutely had kids after I was diagnosed. And of course, like any other mother, I was anxious. I was nervous being a first-time mom, but also worried about potentially transmitting hepatitis B to my children. But I was very lucky that my children received both the hepatitis B birth dose and also the hepatitis B immunoglobulin, and that they don't have hepatitis B. And yeah, that's been a huge relief. But I think that also took a lot of advocacy. You know, my doctor constantly tell me, Nafisa, make sure you ask for the hepatitis B vaccination. And I did. And luckily, my kids were both vaccinated, which is incredibly lucky, because I know that's not the case in around the world for some mothers and their families.
So just take me through that again. Your doctor was absolutely on the case. But even then, you had to push for it. Or you had to remind people that your children needed this.
In Australia, I guess guidelines for care for mothers with hepatitis B, it is part of the guidelines that children should receive timely vaccination. But I think I was just being an overprotective mother. And in fact, I had to go into emergency surgery. And as soon as I came out of it, the first thing I asked was, did my child receive the hepatitis B vaccination? And I think that's just being overprotective and making sure that they didn't, because it is very time sensitive.
As a mother myself, I can tell you there is no such thing as overprotective. That is wanting the best for your child. Cynthia, Nafisa raises a really important point here, because again, I mentioned with point of care testing, it's one thing to have the testing, but you then need to do something about it. And you need to understand what that means in terms of likelihood of transmission and so on. But of course, that also goes further, doesn't it? After delivery, ensuring children get the vaccination they need.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very impressed by what Nafisa said in terms of reminding the doctors when she gave birth. And that's exactly why it is important for that mother to know her hepatitis B status and potentially her risk of transmitting the virus or the infection to her baby. Hence why this is key in the elimination goals that we have set for 2030.
Thank you very much indeed. We keep hearing here that there's a lot to do, but if we go right back to basics, you have clearly done a huge amount in terms of hepatitis champions. And I love the idea that these do not have to be highly intelligent, highly educated, highly motivated like Nafisa, that actually you can take people with low levels of literacy and so on. But how do you think stigma plays into all of this?
The stigma is one of the key things that we start with when we're training. And one of the ways to destigmatize viral hepatitis and take it off people's minds is that this particular training is for women of all disparities. So we don't train educated women alone. We always mix the classes. So we have low literacy women, women who've never been to school, being in the same class with women who are medics, engineers, teachers, and so on. And the very first training we had, which was in 2017, the WHO was so fascinated, they sent a six-man observer team to join the class because they were wondering how we would train a woman who's never been schooled and train a woman who's been to school and a professional woman all in the same classroom. And they get the message and the content right. And we had a director of the Federal Ministry of Health as one of the trainers, because we always like to involve government and the developmental partners when we're working. And they were so fascinated, and we issued tickets to everybody. So it's very important that we take the low income, low literacy people along, because they are the ones that really help to carry the stigma message forward. You find out that if the low literacy people do not believe in a stigma, that stigma does not stay, because the educated people will then say, oh, if a low literacy person does not see it as a stigma, then it is not a stigma. So we focus on getting it across to them that way. And the simple basic message is you cannot get it by kissing, you cannot get it by touching, and so on and so forth. And once the stigma message is taken, then they are ready to listen and assimilate the message about what the virus is all about and how they can prevent it. And so you see low literacy women telling one another, have you gone for your hepatitis screening? Because many of them still go to traditional birth attendants. They don't go to skilled birthing centers. And so we are trying to encourage them, tell each other about viral hepatitis so that they can come in, get screened, and then go to the a skilled birthing center to have their baby. And if they don't have their babies at the skilled birthing center, still let them go and have the birth dose vaccination. And this is really working. We are also trying to co-opt the traditional birth attendants by training them to know when to send their clients to the skilled birthing centers, especially immediately after birth, so that they can get the vaccinations. And it's working. The impact is small because we're working with small groups, but it can be scaled. It is scalable. It is replicable. It is sustainable.
Fantastic. And of course, that's so important. What you're doing is you're going right through. You're starting off with women at every end of the educational spectrum, every end of the socioeconomic spectrum, but you're also working with the people who are working with them, which is great to see. Cynthia, I'm going to ask you, just touching a little bit more on this idea of stigma, whether you think that stigma is different if hepatitis B was transmitted from mother to child rather than, as you say, from person to person or as a result of, say, contaminated blood.
I would like to hope that the stigma will be different, but I think there's still stigma in the sense that whether it's not the child who's being stigmatized because we might say, oh, shame, sorry, that came from the mother, the stigma may also come to the sense of the mother herself, because there'll always be that question about how did she get that hepatitis B and now passing it on to a child. And given that there's very low education about what is hepatitis B, how is it transmitted between many communities in Africa and elsewhere, it's easy for people to think that hepatitis B is also sexually transmissible. It is true that it is, but because we've seen so much about HIV, it's very easy for people to assimilate hepatitis B like HIV. And that comes to the mother, because someone can say, oh, shame, that child didn't ask for it. It was passed on by the mother, so it's the mother's fault and so on.
The mother didn't ask for it either, shall we point out?
Exactly.
Now, we are nearly at the end and we've had a fascinating conversation, but I would just love to know. I'm going to ask you a little bit about guidelines and what you think of them. Missy, what do the new WHO guidelines on the elimination of mother-to-child transmission from 2021 mean for the future, and how do you think that's going to lead to elimination of viral hepatitis?
The new guidelines are very impactful, the way I see it, because it has now brought to the front the goals and targets in a way that they now brought the women and their babies and their unborn babies and women and children generally to the fore. I believe that that is going to help us in the race towards elimination by 2030, because really, the women are a repository for the virus. I know there are other means of transmission. You have different populations that are highly prone to viral hepatitis and other high-risk populations. But we know that women, as a gender, are highly prone to transmitting the virus to their unborn babies. And so by reprioritizing prevention of mother-to-child transmission as a top priority for viral hepatitis elimination, the WHO, I believe, has taken a right step in the right direction. Maybe it shouldn't really be at the point of pregnancy, because that may be pressuring for the women. But I think that with government, policy has to be done in bits. If you give it all to government at a time, they'll say this is too much and they would not want to do it. So starting with pregnant women, they may now spread it later to all other women, and then the general population, like Nafisa said, because everybody really deserves to be screened in case they are already positive. And the advantage is that we have these rapid diagnostic testing kits, which are the point of care testing kits. They're very affordable. They're very easy to use. So this new WHO policy really, I believe, is going to help the whole world to achieve elimination of viral hepatitis by 2030. If we apply it and put a bit of diplomatic pressure on countries to adopt these positive policies.
Now, Nafisa, you have talked about universal testing, but the simple fact of the matter is there isn't universal testing yet. You've also heard Cynthia say that, you know, maybe the perinatal, that round about the time you're pregnant, is not the ideal time because there's a lot else going on. But if we have countries where, sadly, universal testing has not been introduced, do you think that antenatal classes perhaps would be an effective touch point to engage mothers to be in this discussion, because they are very conscious of the health of their baby at that point?
Yeah, absolutely. And I confidently say that because we know from research through other conditions, whether that's hepatitis C or HIV, that those are a really sort of a key point or pathway to engage both mothers, but also their families. We know with hepatitis B, it's usually not one person. If the mother has it, probably the partner might have it, or the auntie or the uncle, or the grandparents. And I think that's a really great way to start the conversation. And I think what we need to go further is providing social and well-being and mental health support for mothers, because it is such a shocking, I think, condition to be diagnosed with. And especially if you're just finding out and you're pregnant, it's just, there's a lot there. And I think mothers especially carry an extra weight of raising children, looking after the household, but also other competing priorities such as work or looking after your family, extended family. So I think we need to have better strategies in supporting mothers through this journey as well.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. Now, speaking of mothers and children, of course, the WHO are introducing new hepatitis C, HCV, guidelines for children in 2022. Cynthia, let me end with you and ask you how you think this will impact the efforts to reach worldwide elimination by 2030.
I think it's very important that they've now come up with proper guidelines to take care of this hepatitis C-infected children. And I can't wait, actually, for guidelines looking at how to take care for hepatitis B-infected children, because we need those as well. Because the advantage that we have with hepatitis C is that we've got treatment, which works. But the disadvantage with hepatitis B is that though the treatment works, there is some condition at which we need to put the children on treatment and so on and so forth. And so useful in terms of caring for that fragile population for hepatitis C, and hopefully, if applicable, put into action, may help us achieve the WHO elimination goals.
Well, thank you so much, Nafisa, Cynthia, and of course, Bissy, for sharing your inspiring and really moving stories of mother-to-child transmission of viral hepatitis and the emotional impact of diagnosis. And thank all of you for listening. Tune in to our next episode, where we'll discuss viral hepatitis in young people and how their unmet needs should be addressed in order to achieve elimination by 2030. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Hepcast. You can also leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts so others can find the show.
The Hepcast is a collaboration between the World Hepatitis Alliance and Gilead Sciences Europe Limited. The Hepcast is fully funded by Gilead Sciences Europe Limited.